Maybe she's not there, but they're here and they're the zombies.
Well, no one told me about her, the way she lied.
Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. That was a clip of the band The Zombies performing their 1964 hit, She's Not There. Today, our show is about zombies, but not that British rock band. Instead, the living dead of horror film and religious legend, I guess. Seems like zombies are everywhere in the movies, on television, and also, how does the Afro-Caribbean spiritual tradition that gave rise to the mythology of zombies fit in? Right now, we welcome to the program Dr. Stephen Schlossman. He is here to talk about a possible scientific explanation for zombies. Stephen is a psychiatrist at Massachusetts General Hospital and an assistant professor of psychiatry at a Harvard Medical School. And he's also the author of The Zombie Autopsies. It's a novel about a plague that turns its victims into zombies. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thanks very much. It's fun to be here.
In Night of the Living Dead, zombies are brought back from the dead by a mysterious force that allows their brains to continue functioning, sort of. You've written several recent articles describing the neurobiology of the zombie brain, and we're wondering, how exactly does a zombie brain function? What's the point?
not well, first of all. We should start with that. So the beauty of this is that because they're fictional characters, and my dean requires me to say that. I'm required to acknowledge.
I was going to confirm that.
Right. Yeah. Right. I just feel like I don't want a War of the Worlds. Like, so they don't exist, but there are constructs in the cinematic zombie that you look at and you just can't help but to think you've seen the same thing in various neuropsychiatric and neurobiologic syndromes in people. So if you look at Romero's first movie, Night of the Living Dead, just from watching, you see the stumbling, the shambling, so you can start to wonder about the mechanisms in the brain that are responsible for maintaining fluid motion and balance. The cerebellum, for example, and the basal ganglia. Can't be working that well, or else they'd walk better than that. They wouldn't have to hold their hands out in front of them for balance. They can't solve problems. They can't open the doors. When they get there, they just kind of stare in the door. So we know that their capacity to think in the abstract is severely limited, and that's primarily a frontal and prefrontal process. So the frontal lobes kind of toast. We know they're hungry, so we can implicate the ventromedial hypothalamus, which is the region of the brain that tells you whether or not you've eaten enough. We know as well that they're angry, or at least they seem kind of always in a fight-or-flight stance, and that's a low-down, very primitive region of the brain, the limbic system, the amygdala especially. So you can play with this all you want, but the fun part is you can watch videos of these shambling about creatures, and then you can ask a bunch of medical students and non-medical students, what do you wonder about them? What's not working right?
And how does that teach them something?
Well, it's fun. First of all, I mean, there's this notion of adult learning where by the time, there's actually neurobiology to this, by the time you sort of enter mid to late adolescence, you've pruned away a lot of your neuronal connections. We've, for evolutionary reasons, the theory is we've already decided that we know what we know. And we spend the rest of our time engaging in something called confirmation bias, where we sort of look for data to support what we think we already know. So you have adult learners, which is what medical students are, coming into the classroom and kind of looking for confirmation what they expect they're going to hear. So they get a short, bald Jewish guy like me coming in to talk about neuroscience, for example, or psychiatry, and they have an idea of what I think it'll be. And then you hit them, you blindside them, saying, we're not going to just start with slides of histopathology or brains. We're going to show you a clip of Night of the Living Dead. And you make them active in their learning process. And it turns out that active process engages a kind of learning that adults are much more adept at engaging in, basically. So that's how it helps in some ways. And the other thing it does is it reminds you that the first job of a scientist or a physician, anybody who's sort of trying to figure things out, is just to observe, just to watch.
My guest is Dr. Stephen Schlossman. He is author of The Zombie Autopsies, Secret Notebooks from the Apocalypse. He is also a professor, or he's a psychiatrist and a professor at Harvard University. He is in neurobiology. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Schlossman, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about zombies. The complete description of your talk tomorrow night is the neurobiology of slow-moving zombies. Right. And you say that slow-moving zombies are more dangerous. And, of course, there is something. How can something that moves so slow in the movies scare the daylights out of us like it does? I mean, can't you just outrun them?
Yes, you can eat a sandwich while you're running away. You got all sorts of time. To me, first of all, I much prefer the slow-moving zombies, not because they're less scary to me. They're a lot more scary, mm-hmm. so I enjoy that conceit more. I think as humans, when we have time to think is when we have time to screw up. So if something's just running after you, like the infected people in 28 Days Later, or even in the remake of Dawn of the Dead, mm-hmm. they're running, you're going to run. You don't really have time to engage your higher cortical processes. If it's just shambling towards you, there's all this time to think, all these moments of indecision. You know, maybe it's not really a zombie, maybe it's still my girlfriend, maybe, you know, there's all this hope going on. And in the end of the day, you wait too long, and they eat you. So I find the slow-moving zombies, first of all, they lend themselves more easily to kind of a medical taxonomy, but also I find them just horrifying. That's the stuff of nightmares, this thing shambling towards you with a kind of dead look in its eyes and the completely impersonal nature of it. It's not even about you. If I step to the side, it'll eat somebody else's guts. My guts aren't even special.
Those kind of zombies don't really seem that angry to me. Like in 28 Days Later, those are ticked off zombies.
Yeah, they're like feral.
Yeah.
The zombies, Romero zombies, until you got a little bit later with things like Day of the Dead, the Romero zombies are just, they're like drunk crocodiles. They're just kind of hungry, stumbling about. And I think that actually makes them more scary, because if something's going to attack you and end your life, you would like it to be about you. You would like it to be very personal, the way vampires are personal when they go after you. The fact that it could care less, that it can't care less, you know, that to me is what creates the horror. So I wanted to talk about that conceit at the talk tomorrow.
I get your teaching method. I'm wondering how you got into it in the first place yourself. Did someone teach you, or is this just something from boyhood?
It was probably a little bit of both. I used to be a high school teacher. I was a high school English teacher and science teacher out in Northern California before I went to medical school. So I've always loved teaching. I've always loved pop culture, especially campy pop culture. It's really fun for me, and I love that mixing of high and lowbrow that comes. I've written academic papers about Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Napoleon Dynamite, and it feels like cheating. I mean, it's so much fun that I get to put that on my CV. but they have relevance. I mean, pop culture, there's a zillion TV shows when Buffy came out, and Buffy was a hit. So you got to kind of ask yourself, what was it about Buffy that made it such a hit? So that technique, I think just kind of lends itself to teaching, that willingness to draw from popular culture, because it's by definition popular, and make what people are learning seem all the more familiar. That's what I like.
And it gives you an excuse to watch all those gross movies.
Oh, yeah, no, it's great. It's a tax write-off. I mean, every one of those movies I rented became work. It was awesome.
You've written the novel, as I mentioned, The Zombie Autopsies. It's about a worldwide pandemic that turns humans into zombies, and at the beginning of the story, one-third of the human race is infected, and scientists have recovered a notebook written by a top zombie expert, or someone who becomes an expert, who has performed autopsies on zombie corpses in the hopes of finding a cure. Is there hope, or is that too much of a spoiler for you?
Oh, no, I'm an optimistic guy. There is hope, and in fact, there's embedded in the book, which is a kind of odd genre book. It doesn't fit well into science fiction or horror, somewhere in the middle with this kind of attempted verisimilitude. But embedded in there are hints as to the missing recombinant organism that was created and released upon the earth by evil hedge fund investors, basically, because they wanted to bet on the market falling. So it's in there. And in fact, I spoke at the Annapolis Book Fair not too long ago, and this 12-year-old kid bought the book, and I first of all made sure his mom knew he was buying it, because it's got like the F-bomb in it, mm-hmm, and stuff, mm-hmm. and she was okay with it, and then he figured it out. This kid emailed me and said, hey, I think I know what bug this is, and he was close, and I said, Google this term, and he did, and he was pulling articles from like The Lancet and JAMA. So there is hope. Hopefully there's hope enough that will allow me to write a sequel or something, but it is solvable.
Yeah, I thought about it. There's the movie I Am Legend, mm-hmm. which is based on a short story or yep. a short novelette type of thing. And the novel, the story is not optimistic.
No.
The movie, as horrible as it is, and I've only watched it once. I can't bear to watch it twice. Is more optimistic.
Are you talking about the Will Smith one?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's basically been three or four iterations of that. There's,
oh, really?
There's the Omega Man with Charlton Heston okay. back in the early 70s. There was The Last Man on Earth with Vincent Price. But all of them are based on that same novella, or I guess it's a short novel, a Richard Matheson novel called I Am Legend. There it's a kind of vampire plague
right.
that takes over. The that ending of I Am Legend, my understanding of that, the one with Will Smith, that has a vaguely optimistic ending, that was actually rewritten to make it kind of more palpable to Hollywood audiences, to make it more mainstream. The same ending happened in the Charlton Heston version. It's not such a great ending. I mean, it's a great ending, but not such a happy ending in the one with Vincent Price. But all of them toy with the same idea of the kind of collapse of social and structural infrastructure.
And whether it can be revived.
Yeah, and whether it ought to be revived, how it can be revived, you know, this kind of constant fear that we have, that seems increasingly, you know, stuff we see on TV, where we see infrastructure. I mean, we see it today in southern Louisiana as they lift up these floodgates. So it's a fascinating coming together. There's got to be some reason all this apocalyptic literature has gotten so hot lately.
2012.
Yeah, right. I mean, all my 11-year-old daughter reads nothing but these dystopian young adult novels, and they're fantastic novels, but boy, are they dark.
You know, speaking of your daughter, according to one article, the inspiration for your interest in zombie neuroscience may have begun when you noticed the unlikely longevity of her pet crayfish.
Right.
Could this possibly be?
This is true. So we have a lot of animals. I grew up in Kansas, so we called them crawdads.
Okay.
And they, after third grade, my daughter's now in fifth grade, in third grade they did experiments with crayfish, and then any parents who were cool with it, they let them take them home. So we said, fine, and they said, don't worry, it's not going to live more than a couple months, and this thing just keeps on living. It like, we give it a little wisp of lettuce every now and then, it's a turkey, and it comes out of its little, you know, inverted pot that we put inside there, that's its little cave, and it's molted two or three times. I have no idea. I mean, it's an incredibly sophisticated organism, or at least it's an incredibly adaptive organism, because it's living in a little Tupperware container now.
Fountain of youth. We have an email from Aaron, writes, I also think the slow-moving zombies are superior, but I think their greatest strength is that they are easily underestimated. One zombie is not dangerous, but a slow-moving mob of hundreds is deadly. Which brings me back to an issue about why, if they're all moving together, aren't they ripping each other apart?
It's a great question. It's the question. So everyone's got a different explanation. And if you talk to George Romero, he'll just say it's the way it works. It makes the story work better. in the book, I was trying to not leave any kind of scientific stone unturned as best I could. So they, like many primitive organisms, because their brain has kind of been eaten down to that most primitive place, will avoid things that are rotting, that don't smell good, that smell like they wouldn't be healthy. So they're drawn more towards the healthier flesh, just preferentially, and they have preservation of the olfactory bulb, the region of the brain that allows them to smell. There's that great scene in The Walking Dead in the AMC series where they cover themselves in guts and can in zombie guts or dead guts, and therefore can walk among the zombies, and the zombies just assume they're walking dead as well. So it's the same. That's at least my explanation.
a quick review of The Walking Dead. What do you think?
I love it. You know, it started out with having to set the stage the way all zombie movies do. There's a kind of trope they have to follow. But then it really, to me, I love the graphic novel series, and then I was skeptical that they could get it on screen, and they really nailed it. They nailed the interpersonal conflicts, which are the core of all zombie movies. Zombies are the things that happen. The interest, the drama, is in how folks deal with it, whether they can leave behind their petty racist notions and their hierarchies and deal with the threat at hand, and they often blow it. They often can't do it.
We have a cut from The Walking Dead real quickly. Let's listen to that.
Things are different now. There's us and the dead.
We ought to warn people away from the city.
Folks got no idea what they're getting into.
Don't you get bit. Bites kill you. The fever burns you out. But then after a while,
you come back.
You know, you have this great educational backdrop for your interest right now as a grown-up, but where do you think the interest is coming from culturally?
It's a, I know the next guest has written an awful lot about this in a really, really smart way. I think there's a couple of things going on. I think, one, we have this phenomena of things pretending to be what they're not, so zombie banks, zombie mortgages, you know, that were responsible for the real estate collapse, mm-hmm. things that appeared to be mortgages but weren't. And then we have this as well. We have this kind of disconnected modern society where you're on hold for a million hours, and they say this, you know, this call will be monitored for quality assurance, but it really can't be because they're monitoring every call, so your call doesn't mean anything. This kind of way that we feel less and less part of a community, which I know is almost a cliche right now, but I think that kind of resonates with folks. And then on top of all that is this kind of survivalist romanticism that you see. I've had kids in my practice say, like after I Am Legend, for example, when that came out, I remember kids would say, you know, I love that movie, not because of the destruction and everything, but because of the simplifying it did. Mm-hmm. You know, all you got to do is, one kid said, look, no homework, no girlfriends, no making my bed. All I got to do is stay alive for the next day. It's really simple. Get my guns, arm my perimeter, and make it to the next day. And that's initially very attractive.
Yeah, life is so simple.
Yeah, I just think it gets boring after a while. And that's what happens in the movies, too. The ennui sets in, and the zombies aren't, you know, stop to be fun to kill, and then you just kind of realize you're stuck. You're trapped by that conceit.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dr. Stephen Schlossman. Coming up, a Southern Utah University professor who has written about the pop culture of zombies. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and join us later this morning for live coverage of the Space Shuttle's final launch as Atlantis makes one more supply run to the International Space Station. Join NPR's Neil Conan for this momentous event as NASA's storied program prepares for its last liftoff. It's an NPR News special, the final launch of the Space Shuttle, beginning at 11, weather permitting, on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from Edible Columbus, a magazine devoted to culinary traditions, seasonal cooking, and the local food movement in our community. More information on the summer edition can be found at ediblecolumbus.com.
71 degrees under cloudy skies. There is a chance of showers and maybe a thunderstorm off and on throughout the day. A high near 81. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 65 degrees. A nice hot weekend, sunny for Saturday, a high of 87. Sunny on Sunday, a high of 90. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Dan Fisher. That was the song Zombie by the Irish rock band The Cranberries. The lyrics of the song are about the state of zombiehood, and it's apparent that these creatures are not just horror film monsters, but are also a metaphor for something gone wrong in modern society. We welcome back Dr. Stephen Schlossman. He's a psychiatrist. And joining us now is Kyle William Bishop. He teaches English at Southern Utah University. And he is the author of American Zombie Gothic, The Rise and Fall and Rise of the Walking Dead in Popular Culture. He's joining us by phone from London, England. Welcome to the show, Kyle.
Thanks, Anne. Hey, Steve.
Hey, I love your book.
Thank you.
Why a book about zombies and film? I guess, why now, Kyle?
Why now is because now's the time. I was going back to grad school to get my PhD in English. And I knew that I wasn't going to be able to crank out a book on Melville that was going to be particularly fascinating. So I thought I would feel out the market. And with the rise of this re-rise that I talk about, this zombie renaissance that came about particularly after 28 Days Later, I got a sense that there was a niche that needed to be filled, and I was all too happy to fill it.
But you mentioned Melville. You could talk about Bartleby, who's sort of zombie.
That's true. That's true.
He's part of that tradition.
You know, you guys are like both serious scholars.
Right.
You're not, you know, there's a serious question to be asked, Kyle.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think Steve kind of nailed it on the head that it's really wonderful that we as academics have the opportunity to do some work that is also fun, that has some cultural relevance, but also makes it entertaining for us.
If you have a question or comment for our guest, we're talking about zombies. It's got to be about zombies. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're also on Facebook, All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. And Terry from Columbus, welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi. I mentioned in the origins of the zombie idea, I've read in Time or Newsweek a long time ago that in the Caribbean, there were people that were drugged to be sort of zombie slaves. They were sort of half awake and not awake and were doing slavish work. And anybody knew about that?
Yeah, we're going to actually get into that more coming up later. But, Kyle, what is the origin maybe of the modern, what we think of as the modern zombie, I guess?
Well, the zombie was brought to the United States from Haiti, from the Haiti voodoo and folklore traditions that we're going to talk about in a minute. But a lot of what was happening in the States was, I argue, that American filmmakers really wanted to capitalize on the popularity of things such as Dracula and Frankenstein. And the zombie provided us with a kind of our monster, kind of a monster for the New World, a monster that was more our own. And it was so timely coming out of that imperialist tradition that it really resonated with turn-of-the-century audiences.
Thanks, Terry.
Thanks.
You mentioned, Kyle, the 24 Days Later, which brings forth a kind of a different sort of zombie than the Romero zombie. This is the fast-moving, rip-your-face-off, ask-questions-later kind of a zombie.
Right.
What do you think the appeal is? There more appeal for that? We were debating the pros and cons of the slow moving versus the fast moving zombie.
Well, yeah, and the 28 days later, they're so terrifying in many ways because they're not dead, because they are infected. They're infected with a virus, something that is on many levels more realistic, and coming on the heels of the devastating AIDS scares of the last century and paranoia about swine flu and bird flu and all these different things that are really more realistic for us. I think that movie started to resonate a lot more closely with audiences who could see infected individuals, violent individuals, as a more realistic source of terror.
There's a political aspect to that, too, because in 28 Days Later, for example, and there's suggestions of this in other movies, and that there's something nefarious going on. There's some nefarious experimentation going on, and it busts loose for one reason or another. In 28 Days Later, it's because of some, animal rights person.
Right.
Yep. The rage virus is let loose.
I think that originates back to Haiti. The idea that the zombie wasn't the monster; it was the voodoo master that created the zombie. And so, in a lot of the modern iterations, we still see that trope prevalent. That something, the man, or science, or the government, is really the one who's responsible. And now we're all the victims of this uncontrolled mad scientist experiment.
Right, right. And the illusion that it will initially be under control. That's like seems to be a big part of it. Like. We will create this thing, and we'll be able to control it and work it. It'll be the perfect weapon, the perfect economic tool, whatever. And then it flies, just like Frankenstein, it just flies out of control.
But in Will Smith's I Am Legend, it was the cure for cancer.
Right.
They thought.
Right. I mean, you see in Mimic, it was the cure for some made-up bug that then turned everybody into that, those horrible insect-like creatures in the sewers. It goes on and on.
Jesse in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Curious about the advent of the comedic zombie movies like Shaun of the Dead and Zombieland. I didn't know if that was a new thing. And I was also wondering about, at the end of Shaun of the Dead, they end up figuring out a way to use the zombies to do things like get the carts out of the parking lot and just these menial tasks. I don't know if there's a question there or not.
Well, I can certainly make a comment. The zombie comedy, or the zombity, which I like to call it, it's really been around almost since the beginning. There were you know, Abbott and Costello zombie movies and things there, really came into its own in 85 with Return of the Living Dead. And I think that the comedy or the parody is just a natural evolution of any film genre, particularly a popular film genre. Because on the one hand, when we're dealing with zombies, it's a cathartic way to deal with mortality and with death. But then the comedy is like a cathartic way to deal with the cathartic way. So it kind of takes us out to another level, which keeps us distant but still close, so we can deal with those issues without becoming too frightened of them.
Steve Schlossman?
Yeah, no, I would agree. I mean, one of my favorite zombie comedies that often doesn't get mentioned is Fido. I don't know if you've seen that one, Kyle.
Oh, yeah.
I love that movie. That's a movie that's sort of a riff on the Cold War stuff, a lot of which I know you've written about, where the zombies are kind of domesticated. And every now and then the collar that they wear malfunctions and they eat somebody and then they have to be re-domesticated. And it's also a riff on the Lassie movies, because the zombie will go, rah, 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 and they say, what does that mean? Well, Billy's stuck in the woods. And so, but I think also, you know, that scene in Shaun of the Dead when he goes in and out of the grocery store in the morning and it takes him about four or five trips, four different mornings, to notice that things are changing, that to me feels like such a wonderful satiric commentary on society. I think that's really cool.
That's the scene that I use to teach a lot, because the idea is, in a lot of these movies, the main argument is that we don't have to worry about becoming zombies because we already are zombies.
Right, right.
And if a zombie outbreak did occur, would anyone even notice?
Right. or can we keep our heads? I mean, we behave with the same kind of violent response, but we have the brains to know better.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
That's the main idea. Jerome in Marysville, welcome to the show.
Hi. Great program. I do have a question, but first I just want to say I'm another short Jewish guy who writes about popular culture. I wrote Atomic Bomb Cinema, The Apocalyptic Imagination on Film, and my key thesis is that you have to look at the Jewish apocalyptic tradition to understand these movies. I'm wondering, you know, Steve, if you've seen any of that, but my real question is, you've been talking about how the real monster is the person who creates the zombies, not the zombie himself. And do you think that goes back to the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari?
Or I guess even Frankenstein, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, for that matter.
Or further back than that.
But in terms of film, if we strictly limit it to film, I mean, that is considered such a key film in terms of film history, and both the history of scholarship on film, with Krakauer's book arguing that you apply sort of Freudian psychology and come up with this you know, enchantment with the this master manipulator, and you have the somnambulist who walks like a zombie,
mm-hmm.
and predates Frankenstein. So I'm wondering, you know, where that comes into the discussion, if either Steve or Kyle have considered that.
I do mention it briefly in my book. It's really more of a footnote, because I think it's such a prevalent visual and tonal influence, and you do have kind of the master sending out the slave, which is really the main archetype for the zombie entirely. But we need to recognize that a lot of these films do not particularly evolve from one source, and the zombie subgenre is a great example of something new arising out of 20, 30 different disparate threads that come together to capture the essence of a certain time and place's cultural anxieties, which is what really happened culminating in 68 and then again now.
The rebirth now. I mean, they are iterative. Speaking from the religious standpoint, it feels like zombie stories are deeply ecumenical to me. Like you have to determine what constitutes, you know, relevant life, relevant human life. I sort of cheated in my book, and because they're infected, but I still had to have them be the walking dead. So I had an ecumenical conference at the UN held where a bunch of religious leaders declared them dead. So now they're just philosophically dead. And that to me feels a lot like the Talmudic arguments that I grew up going to Hebrew school in.
Thanks, Jerome. Joe in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, you touched on it briefly about zombie locomotion.
The older zombies were relatively slow-moving, but for some reason, when you have a young, physically fit woman running at top speed, the zombies always seem to be just behind her. Now, with the more faster-walking zombies, I was wondering if there's a difference in how the zombie was created. And your one guest also mentioned the Talmud, and I was wondering if he thought that zombies and golems were related. And I'll take my answer off there.
All righty, Joe. Thanks.
I can take a stab at
that. I was wondering if there's a difference in how...
Do you want me to take a stab at
that? Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, mm-hmm. So a couple things. One is when I was researching the book, I couldn't help but to think of the golem. And I know that Kyle's written a lot about the golem, too. I love his book because of the way it brings together all these different cultures. I called the head of Jewish studies at Brandeis and said, I need to know whether it's okay to kill a golem once you brought it to life. And she said, yeah, actually, it's kind of a duty. You have to. And then she said, why are you asking? And I told her, and she said, wow, I love zombies. I've always wanted a zombie golem movie. So there are other followers out there for that particular idea. The slow-moving zombies, there's actually – you can medically explain their capacity to keep up with somebody running fast. There's this notion in Parkinsonian-like syndromes where you have poor basal ganglia function that if they have visual stimuli that happens in an uncontrolled way, they move with fluidity. You can see like YouTube videos of people with Parkinson's catching balls with incredible coordination even though they can't do it on command. So you could explain it actually with this kind of surge of dopamine that happens from the basal ganglia, even with a zombie syndrome.
Well, and I'm glad Steve's doing all the scientific research, all the hard stuff, because I approach it from a narratological perspective. That the and he mentioned this a little bit earlier. The relentlessness of the slow-moving zombie is so much more terrifying. It's kind of what I think of as the Pepe Le Pew syndrome. How
you know,
fast and how difficult and how strenuous is always going to be right there.
He's going to get that skunk. He's going to.
Well, that poor little kitty cat.
The cat, I mean.
Yeah.
Right? Not
exactly.
Yeah. Thank you, Joe, for that call. We have a few more minutes if you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And with me is Steve Schlossman from Harvard University and Kyle Bishop from Southern Utah University. So the origins, how has the concept of zombies in movies changed over time? I mean, is it the sort of idea that now we're at the comedic stage and that's just a natural progression and things have to change in the movies just to keep us interested?
I think very definitely. But what we're seeing most right now, the most recent movements in the subgenre, if you will, is there's a strong desire to realize with the zombies what Anne Rice was able to do with the vampires. And so many fans have become enamored with the idea of the zombie that they want to cheer for the zombie and they want to root for the zombie and they really want the zombie to be the hero, to be the protagonist, to be the misunderstood, misfit. And so we're starting to see, particularly in the literature, more explorations of zombie consciousness and zombie subjectivity. And I personally am not as big of a fan of that direction. I like them better as the ununderstandable other, the relentless monster, but I think we are going to see a bigger push in that direction.
I would agree with that. And there's a great novel, Zombie Ohio, that Scott Kenmore wrote that plays exactly with that notion. It's a professor at what's clearly Kenyon College who slowly realizes that he's a zombie and sort of trying to struggle with that. I think we are going to see it, but it also feels like the movies have taken this turn. It'd be interesting to hear what Kyle says towards this kind of massive apocalyptic level. I mean, that wasn't the case in Night of the Living Dead. It was clearly the case by Dawn of the Dead. And it feels like there's this enchantment, both in zombie movies and lots of other science fiction movies, of just this total falling apart of infrastructure. But doesn't quite make sense, giving slow-moving, biting creatures. We ought to be able to just round them up. and yet it always happens. So you have to try to figure out in these movies how we could have screwed up so badly. And to me, that's interesting because it's a nice commentary on other things we may have screwed up so badly.
Could we be getting zombied out, I wonder?
Yeah, I didn't think it would last as long as it has. So I'm just thrilled that we're they're so tenacious and just hanging on and hanging on and hanging on. And more people are discovering them in so many different genres and mediums, with video games and card games and board games. And I think they've got some life in them yet, if you will.
I think that's the first time anyone's made me snort on air. So You guys, you get the prize. I want to say thanks to my guests, Dr. Stephen Schlassman, psychiatrist, Harvard University Neurobiology of Zombies, and is the name of, well, you teach neurobiology of zombies. His book is The Zombie Autopsies, Secret Notebooks from the Apocalypse. It is a novel. Thanks a lot, Steve, for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
And also Kyle William Bishop. He teaches English at Southern Utah University and is the author of American Zombie Gothic, The Rise and Fall and Rise of the Walking Dead in Popular Culture. Kyle, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Last week on Car Talk, once again, we were brilliant.
Absolutely brilliant.
Is it good for a car or bad for a car to not fill it up when you put the gas in it, or to run it low?
Well, no, no, and no.
Right. that about sums it up. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Brett.
For more clear and concise car advice, join us this week for Car Talk.
Car Talk tomorrow at noon on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In 20 minutes, join us for an NPR News special, live coverage of the Space Shuttle's final launch as Atlantis makes one more supply run to the International Space Station. Join NPR's Neil Conan for this momentous event as NASA's storied program prepares for its last liftoff. It's an NPR News special, the final launch of the Space Shuttle, beginning at 11, weather permitting, here on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from B-Dry Waterproofing, with a patented system that stops groundwater from entering a home's foundation, protecting more than 250,000 homeowners since 1958. 1-800-563-BDRY or bdry.com.
71 degrees, cloudy skies in downtown Columbus. There is a chance of a shower or thunderstorm off and on today and a high of 81 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 65, sunny and hot for Saturday, a high of 87. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. You are listening to an authentic voodoo music from Haiti. The origin of the mythology of zombies comes from the Caribbean nation of Haiti and the religious and cultural tradition known as voodoo. Joining us to talk about that is Nathaniel Samuel Morel. Welcome to the show, Sam. Sam teaches philosophy and religion at the University of North Carolina in Wilmington. He is the author of Afro-Caribbean Religions, An Introduction to Their Historical, Cultural, and Sacred Traditions. Welcome, Sam.
Thank you very much.
You write that outside of the Caribbean, ideas of our region, our people, and our religion run amok. Is that especially true because of the current popularity of anything to do with zombies?
Partially. There are all kinds of fables going around, but I think it has to do with, in the case of Haiti, it would have to do with partially the Haitian Revolution and the bad taste it left in the mouths of lots of colonialists.
Take us back in history a little bit. The first colonists in Haiti were the Spanish, who enslaved the native people living there, but the native population declined because of ill treatment and disease. Then the French came. Could you tell us a little bit about that? What were the living conditions?
Oh, yes. When the French came and the French took over Haiti and changed the name, well, that part of Haiti, changed the name to Saint-Domingue, they turned that part of the island into a massive slave plantation economy, as a result of which France made Saint-Domingue the most profitable country in the world per capita. At one point, Saint-Domingue became about 85%, produced about 85% of France's GNP, all on the backs of African slaves. By the time of the revolution, there were about close to 800,000 Africans enslaved in Saint-Domingue under the most brutal of conditions. And in fact, their misery and the brutal treatment of the planters is what sparked the revolution, which rode on the backs of liberté, égalité, and fraternité in France. Because on one occasion, some slaves were so brutally decapitated in the presence of other slaves to discourage any kind of revolt, that the slaves who witnessed the brutal treatment of their fellow slaves vowed to bring this whole system down.
Tell us about the religion brought by the slaves from Africa and the role it played in their lives and their culture as it evolved.
Yeah, the Haitians brought with them what they could remember of their African traditional religion, which came out of Savalu in Togo, Dahomey, and these countries around there in the what we call the armpit of Africa, West Central Africa there. And lots of different ethnic groups from the Fulas, the Polas, the Bambaras, Mandingos, lots of different tribal folks. And they use that to preserve their sanity on the plantation. There were different types of traditions. They were unorganized. They were fragmented before the revolution. But during slavery, the slaves practiced their rituals, what they could remember of the African traditions, the spirits, the gods, used to help them survive brutality and misery. And they did not really organize their religion until the revolution, because it is during the planning for the revolution when the slaves met on a slave plantation in the countryside under two voodoo priests and began to plan their revolt during a voodoo ceremony. So they organized themselves and did their rituals and decided to shake this infamy off their backs through the most bloody revolution in human history.
Mm-hmm.
In Saint-Domingue. I should say one of the most bloody revolutions.
My guest is Sam Morrell. He is the author of Afro-Caribbean Religions, An Introduction to Their Historical, Cultural, and Sacred Traditions. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Sam, when did the concept of the zombie originate, or has it always been a part of voodoo? One writer says that the zombie represents slavery and the living death of slavery, where the individual inhabits a body but is not allowed to have free will.
Yeah, there is a lot of controversy as to exactly where this came from, where it originated. We have faint reflections of its origin coming out of Dahomey through the folk tales, where zombies were believed to be people who died under mysterious means, and perhaps through the machinations of people who worked sorcery or those kinds of things. But it did not have the demeaning characteristics and the foreboding features that are attached to it in Haitian zombification. The idea in Africa was people who either disappeared under mysterious means or had any kind of superstitious death were sorcerized. But in Haiti, the idea of zombies, people being buried alive and being brought back to life through some special bakor or sorceric means, really took on new meaning and significance, especially given the very miserable and harsh conditions people lived in Haiti. I might mention that I never saw any zombies in Haiti.
Just for the record, right?
The only ones I encountered are the people in Haiti who are very, very poor, almost emaciated, almost a poor representation of the human family, physically looking, because Haiti had some of the poorest people in the world.
Right.
All right. When you put that with slavery and misery, a lot of these zombification myths have been propagated by Haitians themselves because there are people in Haiti who believe they're zombies. And it's within the whole tradition of Haitian mythology within the religion. All religions have their myths.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the myths in voodoo is that you can be zombified. Haitians are not afraid of zombies. What they fear is being made a zombie.
Okay. The zombies, in other words, are not a threat.
Right. And it's not something that one person does to you. It's more like a punishment that you can be brought to this state of existence where you lose control of your will and your power and your self-existence.
We have an email from James writes, in The Serpent and the Rainbow, zombies were thought to be created by a powder containing tetrodotoxin, a toxin found in shellfish poisoning, which induces paralysis. Where do you come down on that?
Yes, I'm aware of that, which comes out of Wade Davis's thing.
Mm-hmm.
The hallucinogenic Datura plant and the pufferfish are well known to have certain toxins. It is not impossible. If you study pharmacopoeia, Afro-Caribbean pharmacopoeia, which is very, very potent and popular in voodoo, Santeria in Cuba, and Candomblé in Brazil, that some of these plants could work magic on you in terms of you losing some of your faculties. You could also lose parts of your body, fingers, toes, being affected by some of these very toxic plants. And voodoo priests and Santeria priests and others have learned to use these plants for all kinds of things. So it is not impossible that folks can be seriously affected by these hallucinogenic productions. And I won't be surprised if people use that to affect other people in very adverse ways. My problem would be, can you give someone this and bury them for an extended period of time and then bring them back to life? Well, if you're Jesus, yes.
Because mm-hmm. It would take a miracle.
Yeah, it would take a miracle if you believe in miracles.
Kenneth in Dayton, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi, Kenneth.
Nice show. I was just curious. I have recently seen a program on PBS having to do with some of the voodoo mm-hmm. religion and whatnot. But what I've previously known prior to any recent, enlightenment, including this program, is from horror movies, and other types of Hollywood images and assumptions of what I would have never otherwise considered a religion, would have anything to do with. And just as what you're saying, bringing the dead back to life, drug-induced, comas and fits and so forth. But it apparently, to me, is still a respected practice that is still done in some countries. So the myths and all of the other things that, us in the U.S., have made out of these religions and these practices, what are the positives? What are the, basic constant things of voodoo other than some zombieism, these horrified, slow-moving, dead creatures?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Just curious.
That's a very good question. Yeah, very good question. Voodoo is a living spirituality of Afro-Caribbean peoples, people who have of African origin, who try to preserve their African traditional religions under colonialism and very, very adverse circumstances. In our times, of course, Haiti is not under colonialism, just suffering the effects of it. And Haitian people try to practice their religion with their beliefs in their deities, their gods, and spirits, whom they believe are connected to their ancestors and are used to determine their own spirituality and direct their lives. Much of voodoo practices are not intended to harm people. They are intended to augment people's spiritual experiences and help them survive their day-to-day activities and experiences in life. Their rituals, their practices, their dances, all of those things are designed to enhance spirituality and life.
Thank you, Kenneth. Real quick, Samuel Morrell, this is an email from a listener. They say earlier the topic came up about the creator of the zombie as the bad guy, and this seems very relevant to the history of Haiti.
Yes.
After all, Papa Doc made good use of voodoo tradition by dressing and depicting himself as the god of the cemetery. In a way, through fear and superstition as well as force, didn't Papa Doc make his whole nation his zombies? We don't have just a few seconds left, really, but I wondered if you wanted to address that, Sam.
Yes, indeed. Papa Doc really used this to his political advantage, even though he had some connections to voodoo. Voodoo has been abused by Haitians themselves,
mm-hmm.
especially the politicians, and Haiti has had a history of the most corrupt and evil politicians in the world since the revolution, beginning with their first known president after... What's his name again? After they got their revolution, their independence in 1804.
Right. We have to break it off there, Sam, I'm sorry to say. Thanks for joining us today, though. That's Nathaniel Samuel Morrell. He teaches philosophy and religion at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. He's the author of Afro-Caribbean Religions and an Introduction to Their Historical, Cultural, and Sacred Traditions. Thanks for joining us. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.